This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Damien Carrick here. Welcome to the Law Report. Today, meet Tara Schultz, age 31. As a young teenager, she was sexually abused and addicted to drugs. Last December, her abuser was sentenced by the Victorian County Court to almost 10 years jail. Now, on the Law Report last week, we discussed mandatory drug rehab for children. As you'll hear, Tara has some very considered views about this controversial idea. Tara also has a great deal to say about how to stop kids falling between the cracks, how our legal system deals with complainants in child sex abuse prosecutions, and how to support survivors to build a life. Fate didn't deal Tara Schultz a good hand.
Mum was in care, so Mum suffered from schizophrenia. She was in care throughout my entire childhood from about 4 years old. So I didn't really see Mum that often. And eventually we ended up moving away. So Dad moved to many different towns all over Australia, as he was often the target of police raids for distributing cannabis. And that meant that we never stayed in a town for more than 3 years. And it, you know, meant that I wasn't able to really form a lot of community and friend groups. Dad probably, in all likelihood, suffered from mental health issues, but they went undiagnosed. And it kind of led to a lot of neglect of me and my brother. You know, I think that my dad gets a bit of a bad rap in many ways. I mean, he wasn't a good parent, but he was a good person who just didn't really know the best way to parent children, what they might need and what might keep them safe. We often went hungry. We often experienced a lot of trauma from police raids. And there were a lot of people around us that were not good people, really. They were people that were exploitative and manipulative and violent. And eventually, after, you know, a very troubled childhood, I ended up being expelled from high school. I ended up starting drug use at 13, starting alcohol use at 13, and Dad had left by 14. You know, from about 12, actually, I was groomed, and by 14, I was living with, you know, a predator that had groomed me and was keeping me, as he said, as his wife under God.
Let's talk about that predator. His name was Peter Kumak. He recently pleaded guilty to something like 18 offences.
Yeah, that's right.
Including sexually assaulting a child, supplying drugs to a child, and assault. And he was recently, I think in December 2018, sentenced to 9 years and 11 months jail for his crimes against you. Yeah. So he began to basically groom you at age 12, and he was age 23 at the time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So he was 11 years older than me. And he, I think, identified that I was quite vulnerable. I had very low self-esteem. I was being bullied. As I said, I didn't really have much family or friend group support due to the constant moving and Dad not really being present enough for us. So Peter kind of swooped in and would tell me things that I desperately wanted to hear, that I was lovable and that I was wanted and that I was beautiful and all these things that a teenage or a young girl wants to hear. I think he kissed me about 13, and then by 14 we were having sex and my dad wasn't in the situation.
Where had your dad gone by the age of 14?
He moved out with his girlfriend. So he got a girlfriend that he'd never had a girlfriend throughout our childhood, and he met somebody. You know, it's funny, he asked me, he came up to me and he sat me down. He's like, "Do you mind if I move out?" And I was only 14, so I thought it was great. I was like, yeah, no parent supervision anymore. Like, I can do what I want. I won't be hassled to go to school or to go to work or to, you know, not drink alcohol. I could have free rein and I could continue this kind of, well, what I thought at the time was a relationship, but obviously it was more of exploitation. I could continue that with Peter without any parental oversight. So yeah, he asked and I said yes, and he moved out.
So you're in an exploitative relationship with a much older man who is basically sexually assaulting you as a child. I think you were 14 or 15 and this guy, Peter Kuma, introduced you to methamphetamines. Is that right?
Yeah. So from 14, he was supplying me with cannabis, maybe 13 actually. And then by 14, 15, Dad was gone and he was lining up methamphetamine in the lounge room and then supplied me with speed from then on in, gradually leading to ice as well. He started off being quite nice and everything when I was a 12-year-old, but by that point he was also quite violent, and so the drugs there were a real coping mechanism for me.
So the sexual abuse was accompanied by, he's kind of turning you into a drug addict, but this was also accompanied by physical abuse and emotional abuse, you know, constant put-downs. And physical abuse, I think on one occasion he threw a fan at you and knocked out some of your front teeth. So very serious violence, yeah?
Yeah, you know, from building me up and getting my trust as a 12, 13-year-old, once Dad moved out, he focused on tearing me down, and that was all due to a need to control and isolate me. Unlike other kids my own age, I'd become quite isolated, and I was already trying to overcome a great deal of adversity. And what I really wanted above all else at that point was somebody that would care about me, like somebody like a parent, and he exploited that, you know, in the most heinous way. And as a child, you believe everything that somebody in that kind of position of power has over you. He eventually started telling me that I was unloved and unwanted. He drove a wedge between my brother, you know, what was left of my family, so that I was completely isolated and under his control. And it was all just so that he could keep me for what he wanted me for.
How did you support your drug use?
Oh, he supplied all of the drugs because, you know, I wasn't getting any kind of income as a 14-year-old. But I was with him for 7 years after I turned 16, and I started receiving Centrelink benefits. From memory, I would give all of the money to him, and then he would just supply me with drugs and a place to live and the rest of it, you know.
Did you try to leave him? I mean, were you happy in this situation? Did you try to get out?
The problem is, what a lot of people may not understand is that predators like this don't need to always lock you in a basement in a cage and take away the key kind of thing. They imprison you within a psychological prison in which you feel too afraid to leave. He made me believe that the world was a very uncaring place, and he'd conditioned me to feel anxious sleeping anywhere away from him. It was better the devil I knew than the ones out there that might do worse to me. I did try to get away though. The first instance of me trying to get back power from him was when I contacted youth support and advocacy services to get into a detox at about 16, 17, I believe. I kind of had an inkling that the drugs he was supplying me were a means of control, and I thought that maybe if I could quit the drugs, I might be able to get some of my power back. And I went to Fitzroy Residential Detox. I thought that the detox was just a place to withdraw. What it ended up being was so much more. You know, it was a connection to community outside of the torturous, hellish, drug-fueled landscape, the isolation that I was, you know, not in school. I was in and out of school. I, you know, was struggling to connect with peers or to have any kind of positive role models in my life. So the Fitzroy Resi became my connection to community. It became a sounding board to me to help me understand what I was capable of and what ability I did have to achieve and what, I guess, hope I had of reintegrating back into community. So I went there like a few times. They did help me out with refuges and homeless shelters and stuff like that. It took a while to get away from him, but I eventually did with the help of the youth services.
You'd go to rehab and then you'd come out again and start using again? Was it a question of two steps forward, one step back?
Oh, yeah, yes and no. So the first time I went for cannabis. I was smoking all day, every day. I'd wake up and have three bongs in the morning for breakfast, and I would just smoke all day, rinse and repeat. I did that for years. The first time I went to Fitzroy Resi was for cannabis, and I quit cannabis. I stopped. I've not smoked cannabis, you know, since then. But then I just moved on to other drugs that Peter was supplying me, so speed and then ice. You know, we would have huge, time, it's hard to know how much time was spent in these kind of drug-fueled binges, in which psychosis did come creeping in to not just me, but everyone around me would go into psychosis and become very paranoid and lose sense of time. They would last for a very long time, and I would get to the point where I managed to get myself on a bus and back to the YSAS office and told them I was losing my mind and I was consuming too much ice, and they would get me into detox for a break. And that interruption of psychosis formation is like pretty vital stuff. I was quite suicidal. I even attempted suicide. I shuddered to think what might have happened without it.
I mean, were the welfare authorities, were they involved here? And were you doing any offending that might have brought you to the attention of, say, the children's court, either the welfare jurisdiction or juvenile offending jurisdiction?
No. So I wasn't doing any offending. So DHS was called while I was with Peter.
That's Department of Human Services.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So Child Protection came around and they asked where my dad was what was going on between me and Peter. But we had concocted a story preempting this very situation, and I lied to them about what was happening. It's not uncommon for girls of my background, young women particularly, to see them not being diverted through the justice system like men. So a lot of people in substance abuse services are young men because they're more likely to be picked up by the justice system. Whereas young women like myself, we're more reliant upon child protection.
How did you eventually escape the clutches of this predator?
It was a long process of leaving and going back and leaving and going back. I eventually was able to develop, I guess, the skills that I needed and the confidence I needed through my interactions with the youth support services that I was talking to. So eventually you leave for long enough that you're able to develop other connections, friends, other relationships. So, you know, every time I'd leave for a little bit longer. It took 7 years, but eventually, yeah, through the constant support of youth services and them always helping me to find housing, no matter if I had kind of mucked up my housing last time and left, and they just keep going and keep helping me. And every time, you know, there was never like a kind of, well, you know, we did this for you last time and it didn't work. They would just keep helping me every time I asked for it.
At what age were you able to finally break the ties to Peter Coomer?
20. So it was 12 when it started, and I was 20 when I finally stopped having contact with him altogether. And I moved in with a friend that I had made during one of my periods of absence from Pete, who was extremely supportive. And YSAS also helped me get into education and complete my diploma in liberal arts, which again was a huge factor in helping me to stay away.
You completed this diploma in arts. So you've been going to university, right?
Yeah. So throughout the horrible ordeal, I was trying to go to school. I always dreamed of a life in psychology at the time. I wanted to kind of heal the problems that I saw in my community. And it was, you know, it's very difficult to complete my VC whilst I was in that situation. I remember being taken to TAFE and I picked out a pamphlet for liberal arts because I wasn't getting into psychology at uni anytime soon. And it was through liberal arts that I developed more of interest also in social science, social work. And yeah, I went to university and I completed my undergraduate in human services.
So you've completed a university degree?
Yeah, that's right.
You're about to start honours?
Yeah, I'm in the process of starting honours now and working on my thesis.
Tara Schultz, who recently completed a university degree and plans to embark on an honours thesis. She mentioned earlier her brother. He also became addicted to ice and cannabis as an adolescent. Unlike Tara, he didn't manage to get clean in his 20s. Tara says he struggles with complex mental health problems and high aggression, both of which she attributes to heavy drug use and a traumatic childhood. He has a long history of offending and has received numerous community corrections orders. Tara did shake her drug addictions, but acknowledges that she still very occasionally struggles with mild prescription medication abuse, especially in times of high stress. I'm Damien Carrick, and this is The Law Report on RN, or available as a podcast.
It starts with one thing.
I don't know why. It doesn't even matter how hard you try. Keep that in mind. I designed this rhyme to explain in due time. All I
Look, Tara, I'm really interested. Last December, Peter Cooma pled guilty to 18 charges, including a sexual assault of a child under 16, supplying drugs to a child and assaulting you. He was sentenced to 9 years and 11 months. Can you tell me how that prosecution came about?
Yeah, so that when I was about 25 or 26, I met a researcher that was working with YSAS. This researcher was doing a census into young people accessing services and some of the issues that they faced. And what I learned was that what happened to me and what Peter did to me and the effects of what he did to me, including, you know, the alcohol and drug abuse and mental health issues, they were actually kind of sadly common. And when I learned how common it was both comforting and infuriating. And so that's when I decided to charge Peter for what he did to me. I guess I wanted society to know what was happening to young women and maybe to help prevent it happening again in the future. It was really weird. You don't really know how to commence. I just called the police station and I was like, it was a bizarre kind of surreal process of beginning a charge, particularly 6 years after it all ended. But the police were very supportive, and that was really important to me because of having so many negative interactions with them throughout childhood.
I think ultimately he pled guilty, but presumably he had to make statements to the police.
And yeah.
So there was no trial ultimately?
No, but I did. So he didn't plead guilty at first. He pled not guilty to begin with. So that meant that at the committal, which is when they decide if there's enough evidence to proceed, I had to be cross-examined by his lawyer. It's hard to really describe what it kind of does to you. You know, I knew intellectually that re-traumatisation was a thing and that I would experience it, but it really just kind of sent me spiralling back, having to cope with high levels of distress. But this time I had a lot of support around me and that made a huge difference.
Was giving evidence and being cross-examined difficult?
Yeah, it was difficult. You start to question yourself if you are a good person for the court to even take seriously. You also are subjected to the perpetrator's ideas of what the crime is. You hear that through their lawyer. Even though I was never in direct contact with Peter, I was exposed to what his excuses for the crime were or what his lies about, you know, before he pled not guilty, he made a lot of stories that were not true. So I was exposed to that as well. It's quite a difficult and traumatising process.
Did you give that evidence via a video connection or were you in the same room?
The first time it was via the video connection. Afterwards, he pled guilty and then I read my victim impact statement in the court out loud.
What did you say in that victim impact statement and what was it like for you to read that out to the court and read that out to him, to Peter Cooma?
Yeah, so it was quite a long victim impact statement. It was 8 pages. And in it, I talked about what Peter had done to me, that for a long time I didn't speak out about what was happening to me and I felt like it was my own fault and that nobody cared anyway. I felt like the world had forgotten me. And I also kind of wanted the court to understand that this wasn't uncommon and that girls like me became easy prey for people like Peter and that we don't have as much protection around us as other young people might.
Looking back, you're glad that you went to the police. You're glad you made that complaint.
Yeah, I was thinking about that the other day about whether or not I would do it all again. I did have a few issues with the process. One major issue is the lack of mental health support to victims of crime. You're only afforded 10 sessions with a psychologist in any 1 year under the Medicare bulk billing structure. So 10 sessions is not enough. It's not even a drop in the ocean. And I did suffer immensely. I charged him 5 years ago, but the court process was about 2 years long, and that was the hardest. So my mental health suffered, my studies suffered, but I would do it all again. It was worth doing. It's important to have these stories in society, and it's important that people like Peter don't get away with this. It's important that this cycle be stopped in some way.
It Tara, a Victorian magistrate, Jenny Bowles, who's come up with a proposal for mandatory residential drug treatment for young people. She says that, look, that should be something which is open to a children's court magistrate to order. How do you feel about that idea?
Yeah, I was at first quite against it. I felt like there was a lot of issues that we as a society are not addressing, and that this was a kind of knee-jerk, reactionary, punitive approach to a situation. We can and should acknowledge the need for a facility like this is born from the gaps that we're letting young people and their families fall through. In my situation, I desperately needed safety and protection. I needed mental health targeted, quite intensive mental health support. I even attempted suicide. I was using a lot of drugs. I was self-harming and I was being exploited. So you need to kind of do something in that situation. The lack of support for families is a big issue, but when it comes to whether or not this facility would be beneficial, I definitely think it would have been beneficial in my case. I wouldn't have liked it. If you'd come in and taken me there at 14, I would have screamed blue murder. But if I had a time machine and I was able to implement this, I would definitely have taken myself to a kind of a therapeutic residential facility. Whilst we should acknowledge that there are a lot of gaps in society, inefficiency of our prison systems to actually provide a rehabilitatory environment, the lack of funding for mental health, the lack of funding for AOD, the lack of funding for youth services, it is important that we do maintain our ideals in addressing the overall social issues that are leading to these gaps. But we shouldn't be so stubborn as to deny any attempt that is not ideally what we would like to address these issues. Otherwise, we'll just sit on our hands and continue to do nothing.
So you think that if it's done right, it could be useful and beneficial for some young people, some people under 18?
Yeah, definitely. Like, it would have just made a massive difference in my life if the HS that day when they came over had have taken me away. I wish that they had have put me there. I mean, I don't speak for every disadvantaged young person. I don't want to speak for every disadvantaged young person. All I can say is that I would have definitely benefited from such a facility so long as it's implemented in a very ethical way. You've seen a history of institutions historically doing the wrong thing when it comes to disadvantaged people in the mental health system. When it comes to putting people in facilities for their own good, I still am yet to see very lasting positive effects. And we are seeing a lot of abuses in that situation. So it would have to be done very carefully and with a lot of transparency and oversight.
I've been told by people who've worked in this area in drug and alcohol counselling that you can get people clean at rehab, but if you don't support them once they've re-entered their real lives, they just slip back into substance abuse. And I'm assuming that applies both for people who are adults and children, right? People like yourself at the time. I guess the argument is that if you're going to have a draconian system like this where people are forced into medical treatment, right, forced medical treatment and taking away their liberty, then you've got to then support them as they re-enter the world.
Yeah, and I would encourage people to not look at it as simply addressing drug and alcohol use. Drug and alcohol use is a symptom of a much bigger issue in young people's lives. It's the lack of housing and the lack of parental supervision, the lack of connection with community. And what I would like to see if this facility was to go forward is a system quite similar to the adult rehab facility. So you go from, I guess, a secure facility where you can't leave, you're not allowed to leave. But after, I guess, several months, once you've stabilised, you can come and go as you please. So I would like to see the young people being supported back into the community and also developing connections with their community. That's the important thing to me. It's not just the absence of doing drugs. The major issue is the isolation, the disadvantage and the marginalisation. So in order to truly help young people, the facility would have to address those issues, and to address those issues, it would have to focus on much more than simply drug withdrawal.
There's an idea of the human rights of individuals and of children, that you shouldn't lock them away. Other people say, well, there are two forms of human rights, the right to liberty and the right to be kept safe.
Mm. Children are a little bit different to adults. There's a lot of things that we make children do that we can't make adults do. We don't mandate that adults have to go to school, for example, whereas children are legally required to attend school. There's a lot of legal requirements placed on children for their own welfare and well-being. So, yeah, I think we can get a little bit carried away with civil liberties arguments. You know, it's not the Wild West. We do have a responsibility towards young people. One of the major issues that I had as a young person is that nobody was taking responsibility for me.
Nobody was setting boundaries.
No, nobody was coming in and asking me what I needed, and nobody was really addressing the problems that were happening in my life. As my dad asked me before he left, he gave me the freedom to choose whether or not I wanted my parent in my life. And I said, no. Does anyone truly believe that I made the right decision there and that I was able to look after my best interests? I wish that I had more oversight and people caring for me. And I definitely needed that.
Look, finally, Tara, the amazing thing is you've completed your degree and you're about to commence your honours year. And I believe you're going to focus your honours year around this proposal, around this idea of whether or not we should have mandatory rehab for people under 18. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are a lot of interesting issues involved with this proposal. It would have helped me immensely, but I am concerned and I am as cautious as everyone else when it comes to locking people up who have not committed a crime, you know, depriving people of their rights and their civil liberties. But at the same time, we have to do something, and I'm really interested to explore this issue. And I'm sure, you know, maybe my position will change again, or maybe it won't, or maybe, you know, it will obviously become more elaborate, but it is a very complicated situation. In a perfect world, we would address all the structural issues that are leading young people to need support. But I don't see those being addressed anytime soon. It is a Band-Aid solution in many ways, but, like, why would you refuse a Band-Aid? You know, we do need them occasionally.
And, of course, those issues around incarceration are especially relevant for Indigenous Australians.
Yeah, yeah. And there was, you know, when I first heard about the proposal, it kind of brought to mind the policies in the Northern Territory that enabled police to incarcerate Indigenous people for public drunkenness. And that was a disgusting abuse of human rights. That's what makes me kind of concerned, is that this policy will target disadvantaged people, it will target marginalised people, young people from Indigenous backgrounds, people with acquired brain injury, people from poverty. I do believe that if this policy proposal is to be rolled out, it is one that is empowering, not further marginalising or disadvantaging young people. And as I said, young people are still being locked up, Indigenous people are still being locked up, but they're not receiving support or the tools that they need to take control in their lives. They're just being further marginalised by prisons, secure welfare, being jailed for public drunkenness. And I think it's about time that we do implement a genuinely therapeutic approach.
Tara Schultz, a remarkably irrepressible and erudite young woman. Resilience is an overused word, but I'm sure you'll agree Tara's story is extraordinary. Now, if this story raises issues for you, please contact Lifeline on 131114. That's 131114. That's the Law Report for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and also to sound engineer this week, Selwyn Cousins. Don't forget you can listen to the Law Report anytime, anyplace by subscribing to the podcast. And you can do that at the ABC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
I could lie, say I like it like that, like it like that.